Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. It's a nice sunny day in January 2018. It's quite spring-like actually. Today's podcast is entitled The Uses and Abuses of the Concept of Nature. Now, as an Englishman, I entertain a certain romanticism around the idea of nature. And particularly as an Englishman who grew up in an industrial area of the country and was touched by the whole factory economy and so on. And if you just cast a cursory glance over English culture, you will see that this is a feature, of British culture, I should say, more accurately. I think of the paintings of Turner and Constable. Still, extremely popular. Works of Blake, the poetic works of Blake, Wordsworth, and more modern nature poets. And we've got Ted Hughes. R.S. Thomas, Dylan Thomas. And this romanticism of nature is kind of present everywhere. And I think there's something good and true about that. We are, after all, as human beings, creatures of nature. We have the DNA, which all other living creatures share, obviously with our own particular variant of it. Warm-blooded mammals. We reproduce through sexual reproduction. We breathe the air. We eat food derived from the environment and excrete waste products back into the environment. We're creatures of nature in a trillion ways. But I'd like to argue that the term nature is used ideologically in many instances. What does this mean? It means that sometimes that the word nature is used to produce a particular political effect. In other words, it's used to justify and promote certain patterns of dominance, or if you want to put it another way, certain inequalities of wealth and power. For instance, you'll hear this quite a bit. It's less frequent now than it used to be, but it's still alive and well. And that's the notion that it's natural for men to dominate society over women. And for the man in a family to be the head of the family, to use the terminology. In other words, to have the power. And this is taken as natural. And when you say a dominance pattern like this is natural, you might actually have a bit of an argument by appealing to the way mammals behave in nature. We are, after all, mammals, where there are different instinctual, hormone-driven behaviour patterns between the males and the females. So you can mount a kind of argument, even though it's one that's fairly easily squashed with a little bit of reflection. But of course, you say natural. You say that this dominance pattern is natural, and you're saying that there's no further question to be asked. The term itself functions to stop inquiry, argument, imagining different situations, questioning the value or otherwise of that particular dominance pattern. It's designed to stop the argument. It's designed to make everything look as though it's a given. And other examples would be class, economic class. We get the idea that economic class is natural. It's inscribed in nature. This is really a variant of the idea that the class structure and the dominant structure of a society is God-given. But it sort of waters it down a little bit and makes it more suitable for epochs in which the God idea doesn't have as much purchase as it used to, namely our own epoch. You're more likely to persuade people by saying it's natural that some people rise to the top of the heap than to say that it's God ordained, even though the structure of the argument is exactly the same.
Thank you.
And whereby it's either the concept of God or the concept of nature is designed to cut the argument short and to justify and render unquestionable a particular pattern of unequal distribution of wealth and power, or if you like, a pattern of dominance within a society. So nature performs that function. Vis-a-vis social class, I always use the same example because it's so stark. The Victorian hymn, still popular, "All things bright and beautiful." And the rich man in his castle, the poor man in his gate, God made them high and low, each to his own estate. So there you see in action the transcendental guarantee of the social order, rendering the social order unquestionable. And that applies to social class, to gender difference, and to differences in status and so on. So when you see nature as a concept operating like that, you realise that, well, it's ideological. In the same vein, but a little bit off to the left perhaps, is the way in which a bottle of carcinogenic shampoo has got the word natural emblazoned across it, or natural ingredients. You know, and that ties in with the whole idea of greenwash as well. And what happens here when you get this greenwash or this all natural ingredients across a product, stamped across a product, is an appeal to our nature romanticism, which has been firmly embedded in us through our culture, and through nature painting and nature poetry and so forth. But of course, the term in this respect, it's not a protected term in law or anything like that. It's kind of pretty meaningless. You can put one drop of lavender oil in a bottle of paraquat and slap natural across the bottle. You know, so we get that kind of cynical manipulation that's such a feature of commerce and our corporate state economy. And that's another abuse. And you can find that one all over the place. once you start seeing it, you realise what a kind of tacky trick it is, but nevertheless it does seem to work. We also find a use of the concept of nature in political philosophy, particularly the venerable political philosophy of the West. And I'm talking about Locke and Hobbes, Rousseau. And that whole discourse. And these political philosophers utilise what is called a state of nature argument, in which one attempts to explain the features of a society and its economy by harking back to a primordial state known as the state of nature, and attempting to explain how property arose in a state of nature, and therefore as a venerable emergence from our origins should be placed beyond question and regarded as natural. Again, you know, property is natural on this sort of Lockean idea. Also, we have ideas in the same vein, like those of Hobbes, whereby Hobbes imagines the state of nature and finds that it's something that nobody would want. For Hobbes, in the state of nature, life was nasty, brutish and short, and social relations were characterised by the war of all against all. And it was only by a central authority with great power exerting its power that some kind of social harmony with its benefits came about. This was the Leviathan, the monarch, the absolute monarch. We should remember that for a very long time, kings were thought to have the divine right. They were either next to God, or in fact divine themselves. They were gods themselves, or inspired by God, and therefore were unquestionable, could do what they wanted. It's called the divine right of kings. And of course it did get unseated by various revolutions and so forth. Eventually. So this nature argument, again, in this articulation in which there is an appeal to some kind of imagined original state of human society, again vouchsafes a gross inequality of wealth and power and places it beyond question. Like in contrast to Hobbes, and right in later time, Rousseau thought the opposite. Thought that in the state of nature, life was harmonious, people were happy, and that it was only the emergence of social order that happiness was lost, which placed Rousseau in a camp that wanted to, at least theoretically, to dismantle society so that the natural state could emerge. So for Hobbes, natural state, terrible. For Rousseau, natural state, good. But what we need to notice here is that both arguments rely on a state of nature argument. They both imagine, it's the key word, imagine, the original state of nature. And the dodgy thing about state of nature arguments is that that can be kind of structured how you want. You can construct the argument to suit the desired outcome, or the political philosophy, or the political utopia that you want to promote. And this is how Rousseau's and Hobbes' state of nature can differ so much. The thing is, it's only in imagination that we can construct the state of nature. And for all the archaeology in the world, we don't really know exactly what it was like when human beings emerged. There's some ideas, but there's nothing conclusive. So these arguments are dodgy for that reason. and actually lend themselves to ideological constructions, to justifications of existing power relations, or to suggestions of other power relations that might possibly obtain, and which for some philosopher or another is desirable. Now we have another variant of the use of the concept of nature. And I should say that so far, what we've come up with actually are abuses of the concept of nature. Apart from the romantic inspiration of nature poets, nature painters and so on, I think what we've got is abuses. This third one is the notion of human nature. And this does exactly the same job for ideologues of cutting off the argument. You say, oh well, it's human nature, and that's the end of it. Can't be any different, it's human nature. War, as much as we hate it, and as much pity as there is in it, is a direct result of human nature, therefore there's no point making any effort to try and stop it. This argument has been used to justify such things as slavery as well as war. And basically, it fulfills a generally conservative idea of cutting off any attempt to formulate how we might improve things. Human nature, you can't go against human nature. You'll hear this every day. You'll see it in the tabloid press, and numerous YouTube videos and all the rest of it. This idea, human nature. Now, many years ago, I remember a Marxist acquaintance, a guy actually was a Maoist, and it was back in those days, and we were having these conversations, of course, all the time. And the guy says to me the one day, there's no such thing as human nature. And I kind of, my jaw dropped open, and I thought, well, actually, maybe he's right. Now, with hindsight, I would say that that was a little overdrawn. And I should mention that Marx did have himself had a fairly clear idea of human nature. But if you take a look at the way humans behave and the way they organise themselves in societies and the way their characters get structured in different epochs, in other words, historically, and also in different places, geographically, there is such enormous variation in the way that we are that if there is a human nature, it's quite easily modified and overwritten, and it's the overwriting that calls the tune. And I would say this goes to the extent that the concept of human nature is not that useful, and for any serious analysis and any nuanced attempts to picture our situation. And then as it actually happens in the real world, the term gets used, as I say, ideologically, which always means to silence a counter-argument, to silence a line of inquiry, or to draw it to a halt. So far the moral is, be very careful with this concept. But I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But I don't want to abandon it completely. I'm an Englishman. I'm a romantic. Give me Wordsworth, sitting on the side of a hill, contemplating the sky. Give me Turner strapped to a mast in a storm. So can we put the concept of nature to any use? Beyond romantic art of one sort or another. And I think we can if we're careful. And if we have very sharp ears for the ideological tune. And roughly how I would propose that we use the concept of nature is to see it as one of a number of embedded systems. In other words, let's see nature as that which embeds culture, and to see culture as that which embeds the human being. So almost like Russian dolls in this preliminary formulation. We've got the human being at the smallest scale, culture at a bigger scale and more collective, and then nature at a bigger scale. And each one containing, as we go outwards, containing what's the others, the smaller ones. Now, that's a bit crude. And I think we also need to realise that these boundaries between these embedded systems are actually not very hard. And in fact, we've got an entanglement. You can imagine tentacles arising out of the human being and tangling with and enmeshing with the tentacles of culture, which are reaching into the human being. Now, before I go on painting this picture, I want to say that this is a pragmatic, metaphoric system to help us to get a picture, a nuanced picture of where we're at. And it's a picture which I think we can employ usefully to appraise our desires for the future, our desires for our descendants, our utopias. And I think it has a part to play in that necessary analysis and hermeneutics. So, we have the human individual. Human individual uses a language, and in that way they send tentacles out into the next system, which is the culture system. But they acquire language through culture, and in that way culture extends its tentacle inside the human being and into the ability of the human being to speak to themselves and to analyse through language and to express through language and to talk to themselves through language. Now, this is only one instance of the way this entanglement is working between culture and individual, human individual. And you could spend a lot of time really elaborating this. And if you do this right, it has the virtue of being based on observation and of being able to appeal to observable, ordinary phenomena. Now, the next system, the bigger system, is the system of nature. And by this, I suppose another word, and perhaps a more neutral word we could use here, would be biosphere. But both the culture and the human individual are embedded and entangled with the system of nature. Now, the system of culture is embedded in nature through agriculture, as just one instance and the most obvious instance. And agriculture, of course, relies on biospherical processes or natural processes of growth and decay and soil and photosynthesis and all of these things which enable human beings to get the inputs that they need. There are also extractive and economic relationships with nature, such as mining metals, fishing, which again is to do with food and nutrition. And of course there's also waste disposal from the collective efforts of human beings, in which there's an interaction between nature and culture through the way in which waste is disposed of or waste is thought of. And these are actually cultural matters. Also, language, obviously, is a cultural matter. Has got plenty of names for the parts of nature and for the significant natural systems and entities that human beings have an interest in. So language, again, is forming a part of this entanglement of these tentacles which reach into nature from culture and reach into culture from nature. And of course the other use is the fact that we reflect upon that which sustains us, Mother Nature, through religion, through poetry, through art, and so on. But also, it comes down to the direct interaction between the human individual and nature, because the human individual, as I mentioned earlier on, is nature. I've got pretty well 90% the same DNA as that duck over there, or even this tree. You know, we belong to the same biochemical systems of growth, decay and transformation, and energy transfer. We belong to that, as animals. And of course we breathe the air. We have this direct metabolic relationship with nature through breathing, which is necessary to us while we're alive. And we eat food derived from the biosphere or from nature, through hunting, through agriculture, through gathering, and through manipulation of the very biochemical processes of growth and decay. But also we excrete. Again, this is an interaction with nature. It is a metabolic relationship between a human individual and nature. And of course, reproduction, which often gets portrayed as entirely natural. It's only human nature, after all. When, of course, there is like a huge overlay of culture and a huge variety of customs and practices surrounding sexuality, sexual expression, reproduction, childbirth, child rearing, and so on. That metabolic matter of human reproduction in the fullest sense. We should also bear in mind that human reproduction is also, if we want to get a bit Marxist about it, tied up with the reproduction of labour power, the reproduction of functionary roles in a particular society. Sometimes through caste or social class systems, sometimes through meritocracies or whatever. So there's a whole way in which the use of the concept of nature, in quite a non-ideological way, can enable us to paint a picture, a very detailed picture, of where we're at and how we fit in these other systems. Whilst at the same time, if we do it properly, we remember that the systems are not entirely discrete. They are deeply entangled and enmeshed with each other. And of course, elaborating such an idea, such a metaphorics, does require the human imagination. It is itself a product of the human imagination, and itself embedded in all of these entanglements that I've just loosely described. So, where does that leave us? Well, I think you can see there are abuses and uses of the concept of nature. I think it behooves us to be alert to that and not to rely too heavily on the concept of nature without some careful consideration in the first instance. So, summary of the actual substance of what I've said there. The abuses of nature, there are ideological abuses to do with the promotion and preservation of inequalities of wealth and power. There is a whole trope in political philosophy which appeals to a state of nature, which is itself ideological but in a different way. and that for political philosophy we probably need something a bit better, given that it's a bit wishy-washy when you examine it closely. There's the idea of human nature, again, ideological. Now, there is a human nature, I would say, you know, I wouldn't want to be too brash as my merest friend was. But we really, really do have to account for how malleable it is. So, on the positive side, we can use a concept of nature in a rather more neutral, less ideological way. Even though probably there is no complete escape from ideology. We have to recognise that using it this way is pragmatic rather than metaphysical. We use some fuzzy boundaries which help us to get a picture of where we're at, but we need to realise that it is a picture, and perhaps it rises and falls by its use and benefit. So, and that use of nature, I think, regards it as a system in which the human individual is embedded, which is itself embedded in the cosmos. Because I'm going to take it that by nature we mean the biological stuff going on planet Earth, really. Beyond that, the cosmos, something rather more cold and impersonal, which I didn't mention before. And between nature and the human being, culture, even though the human being is nature and has an intimate relationship with it through its own biological animal existence. So I think that's where we're at with that. It's a bit noisy with these trucks driving up to the incinerator. Ah, the joys of technological living. Anyway, thanks for listening. I hope it's helpful and maybe even entertaining.